Hello, I'm Simon Mercer, and welcome to the first, the initial, the inaugural episode of Crave, a podcast about films, music, television, and anything else that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe in the last week.
This week, we'll be looking at Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, the latest installment in the increasingly preposterous Mission Impossible franchise, and, let's be fair, the increasingly preposterous career of Tom Cruise.
Also be talking about 13 Minutes, a German film based on the true story of George Elser, a carpenter turned would-be assassin who failed by the eponymous 13 Minutes to kill Adolf Hitler in 1939.
We've also been listening to a rather bizarre reworking of The Who's rock opera Tommy. It's been turned into a bluegrass workout by the Hillbenders.
Indeed that has, and last week we also saw Manchester guitar legend Johnny Marr at Auckland's power station.
We'll be asking if Series 2 of True Detective is actually any good or not.
Here's a question, but let's start with Mission Impossible, Steve. The latest, it's the fifth version that Tom Cruise has put out. So is it a case of mission accomplished or just impossible to sit through? What's your initial thoughts on that?
Well, I went into this film with very, very low expectations. I just assumed it was going to be a series of stunts, a series of chases, a series of bangs and explosions, and that would be about it, really. And I was actually expecting very little from it. I expected nothing in the way of script or character development or anything actually of any interest. So I was actually surprisingly impressed with how much of all of those things they managed to incorporate. It was really rather good.
Well, it was certainly entertaining. Let's just set the scene for this. As I say, it was the fifth installment in the Tom Cruise-led series, because he produces them as well, of these Mission Impossible films. In this latest film, the IMF, the Impossible Mission Force, finds itself decommissioned after complaints from the CIA. At the same time, as a rogue, hence the title, mysterious organization called the Syndicate is committing criminal acts of mayhem and terror around the world. At the same time, Steve, as a mysterious female agent called Isla Faust, yes, Faust, double crosses, or is it triple crosses, her way in and out of the storyline as dizzyingly as one of her deadly leaping scissor kicks. Head IMF-er Ethan Hunt, who's our Tom, of course, is baited by the syndicate boss Lane into tracking him down. And so, as you say, we launch into this fast-paced series of action sequences. They're at the opera, they're under the water, they're on the back of rather fast motorbikes. It's just pretty much non-stop. I don't want to say too much more about the plot, but that kind of sets the scene rather well, I hope.
Well, I think what you've really done there is capture the degree to which it's a contrived, convoluted, overly bizarre and intricate plot, which isn't entirely a bad thing, to be fair. I mean, it kept us entertained. But I was disappointed by the way that so often the plot was driven by very convenient gadgets that just showed up. It was just a little bit too convenient that things just fell into place all the time. There's one wonderful scene, for example, and I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, where Tom Cruise has to parachute into a facility. At this point, supposedly, there is no IMF. He's working off script, off reservation, whatever you're going to call it, and yet somehow he's got not only a parachute, but a plane to parachute from. No attempt is made to explain where this came from, how he got this. Everything just falls into place because it's Tom.
That's right. It's like this IMF has unlimited resources even when it's not being funded, which is
even when it doesn't even exist
exactly.
Any longer. It's,
yes.
It all just falls together a little bit too tritely. So it's probably best to disregard the story such as it is and focus not even on Tom Cruise, who I'm going to say isn't even the star of the film, quite frankly. He spends most of the film talking through clenched teeth, and everything is very urgent, and we must solve problems, and we must save the world. And you're thinking, please, mate, can you just relax and have a bit of fun with this film?
Yes.
There's no levity, there's no humour, there's no lightness. Everything is intense, and it's almost exhausting to listen to him most of the time, which is why I was so glad to see Simon Pegg as brilliant as he was.
Right. Now, he, yes, yes. Now, Simon Pegg, he's one of the recurring characters in the series, as is Jeremy Renner and Ving Rhames. They're the crew who've come back again for the fifth time. And he is really, he provides the comedic element, doesn't he, Steve? He's got that sort of, he's meant to be the geek, but he's the geek who's trying to get into the field and prove he can do the business out there in the real world.
See, I think you're doing him a disservice, to be honest, dismissing him just as the geek and the comedic element. I think that might have been his raison d'etre for the first few films, but I'd say he pretty much carries this latest one. Ooh. He's given a lot to do. He's a bloody good comic actor, he really is. But he's just a good actor, and his character is front and centre in the film, in many ways as significant a character as Ethan Hunt's, Tom Cruise's character. I was very impressed with Pegg in this. I think he carries the film quite brilliantly.
Okay, well, I'll take a bit of an issue with you on that one, Steve. I think he's really very prominent in the beginning of the film, absolutely. But I thought as the film went on, the new character, played by Rebecca Ferguson. This is this agent, this British agent called Isla Faust. I thought she came more and more into prominence and became a foil for the Tom Cruise character as the story developed. But I agree with you absolutely about Cruise. In some of the earlier versions of these films, there was a more of an emotional depth to his character. We saw his wife being kidnapped and what her fate was driving his character through the story. But this time, yeah, you're right, he's pretty much there for the action sequences to show off his how his abs are looking these days, and the fact that he can still run and jump and do lots of his own stunts. But yes, there's not, apart from that, he's kind of just doing it by the numbers.
It did feel a little bit self-indulgent on Cruise's part, to be fair. I mean, there's a couple of nice little gags that take a jibe at his lack of stature, which is well documented. The man's not the tallest creature in the world. And so early in the film, there is one sequence where he is chained to a pillar with his hands behind his back, handcuffed behind the back of a pillar. And had he been at least of average height, he could probably just have lifted himself over it. But because he's only short, then he's trapped. So there's a little bit of self-mockery going on there. But other than that, it's Tom Cruise rides a motorcycle. Tom Cruise does a ridiculous stunt where he's hanging off the end of a plane, which, incidentally, is not a spoiler. It's in the trailers. It's in the posters. It's in the pre-title sequence.
Yes.
That's what this film is about. As you say, in previous installments, we had emotional depth, we had character. They have stripped away dimensions until we're left with something rather flat and wooden.
Well, actually, and that leads into a very wonderful quote, and I'm sure you remember it, Steve, near the end of the film, where the character of the CIA boss, played, I thought, rather well by Alec Baldwin.
Oh, he was having some fun with this film, wasn't he?
And he?
Now, is this going to be the quote that had the entire audience howling with laughter?
It was a wonderful quote. Did you? I'm not sure whether we should give it all away in this juncture, but it was a sort of a summary of what the IMF and Ethan Hunt was all about. And,
I know, but I think we should save it. I think we should let people enjoy
it.
They should.
But it was it was one of the great comedic moments that really, as you say, had people genuinely laughing out loud. And there were others, and Simon Pegg was certainly one of the ones delivering those, especially in the first half of the film. But let's talk a bit more about some of these other characters. We've talked about Tom Cruise a lot and Simon Pegg, yes. Rebecca Ferguson, yes, and Alec Baldwin. There are some others as well. I thought Sean Harris was pretty good baddie.
Yes, he was. He was pleasingly reptilian, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. But having said that, Jeremy Renner and Ving Rhames, the two other members of the IMF crew, I don't know. I felt sorry for them, actually, Steve. I've wondered if they thought they had enough to do, especially in the first two-thirds of the film.
Well, I guess basically, if your name's not Tom Cruise, then you're grateful for what you get in a film like this, really, to be honest. They put up a decent fight, I think. My big problem, of course, is anytime I hear Ving Rhames' voice, that wonderful hollow baritone that he's got, I'm watching Pulp Fiction. I can't get away from that with him. It's my fault, it's not him. But that's always going to be the association there. And I will never, ever be able to hear his voice without hearing the words, no, man, we are very far from being okay. And and unfortunately, he's ruined himself for me. That's my take. But yeah, they were the comic relief that I think maybe Simon Pegg had provided in previous films.
Yes.
In moments when, for example, they're finding themselves in Morocco as part of the wonderful travelogue. It was like, it was, if you remember in the recent remake of Walter Mitty.
Oh, really?
Then you got the impression that basically the cast just wanted to visit lots of interesting places. Well, do a scene in Iceland next. Okay, off we go there. And you could tell that the story had been written around the crew's travel bucket list. And I kind of got the feeling from this film as well that they were, you know, where were they? They were Austria, they were London, they were in DC for a while, then they were off to Morocco. They went all over the damn place.
Yeah.
And you kind of got the sense that basically this was Tom Cruise having a bit of fun and everybody else was along for the ride.
They were, and actually that's a good question. I'm just trying to think, where do you put this film? How do you characterise it? It's partly a James Bondish sort of a film, particularly in the sort of Roger Moore type era, perhaps. Although
that's damning. That's crushing.
I know. Well, some of the humour made me think that. Some of it at times, I think, had an element of farce in it. There's a sequence in the opera, as you say, in Vienna. And I'm starting to lose count of how many assassins are there.
Yes.
Almost taking the mickey out of itself, I thought, at times. At other times, it was just there were some genuinely, absolutely tense action sequences in car chases and motorbike chases. The underwater sequence, although I thought it dragged it out a little bit too long, and I was beginning to think this was going a bit too far. But so you've got that sort of action sequence, yes. Humor, yes. It's almost a comic book approach to it, the story.
Given that, I think that's an interesting comparison, given that comic books seem to be dominating blockbuster cinema releases lately, maybe the directors felt that they needed to start addressing that niche. If comic books and that kind of mentality is what's selling films at the moment, then maybe we need to tap into that. Maybe we need to add elements of that. And yes, you're right, there was some broad humour. I wonder, to be honest, how much of that was actually intended for the audience to laugh with the film, how much to laugh at the film. There were moments where I started to think that it was like, it was not actually simply self-knowing and self-mocking. It actually was taking itself seriously. I was trying to struggle to find the line between the actual humour and the we are so far up ourselves we don't know what we're saying. Maybe that was just me, but I didn't think that was entirely clear.
No, I agree with you on that. I agree. I think sometimes I felt, oh, they're being quite clever here. They're poking the stick at themselves. And other times I thought, no, you are taking yourself too seriously. But here's the thing, Steve, maybe we should wrap this up. This series, this is the fifth.
Yes.
I guess we'll see how this one earns money. But the previous four have done rather well. They've earned more than $2 billion at the box office around the world. And the most recent one, the one before this one, the one called Ghost Protocol, that had been the most successful commercially. That earned around $700 million around the world. So if this one does all right, they'll probably, well, who knows, they might do another one. I thought they just ended the film without giving too much away. They did tease it in a way with the new character, Isla Faust, to suggest that there could be a return from her in another installment in the franchise. Who knows?
They didn't leave it too obviously hanging on an obvious sequel. I mean, I've seen some films where you think, okay, I can't wait to see the sequel because it's so obvious they just set one up. This one, you walk out thinking, okay, that was a self-contained film. Yes. It doesn't need a sequel. It's not specific. I mean, it's not like some of the recent Marvel Comics films where they actually show you effectively a trailer for the sequel in the after-credits sequence. They didn't go that far.
No,
that would be pretty blatant.
No.
But no, it tied itself up nicely. They could end it here if they didn't feel the need. But,
That's
right. As you say, one of the great cash cows of modern cinema. Speaking of which, incidentally, was it just me? Or given that the Greek financial crisis has been all over the news lately, when at the beginning of the film they started talking about the IMF, I wasn't immediately thinking of Impossible Mission. Maybe that's just me.
Well, we did see a lot of funding for the film. Some of the companies that funded it were China-based companies. Yeah.
Yes, this is definitely the way that film funding is looking to go in the future, clearly. That's where the money is in the world these days.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so that was Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, the fifth and latest installment from the Tom Cruise films, which we, I think, would say were entertained by, occasionally irritated by, but I think it was an entertaining couple of hours.
I think that's a pretty reasonable synopsis right there. Now, by way of contrast, 13 Minutes is a German film with, obviously, English subtitles that tells the true story of Georg Elser, who was a German chap who managed not to be swept up by the Nazi machinery of the 1930s, which was obviously something rather rare in Germany of that time. And so
yes,
a film has been made now of the attempt that he made, as it turns out, as an individual, as a lone actor, to blow up Adolf Hitler in 1939. Obviously, there's no spoilers here when we say that the plot failed, obviously. But what the film then explores is, rather than the attempt that he made himself, it explores his motivations and what led up to his attempt to assassinate Adolf Hitler.
Yes, and that's really the most interesting question that you follow as the way the filmmaker tells the story, because the film starts, Steve, with the actual failed assassination attempt, and we see very early on the character Georg Elser being apprehended by the Gestapo and the criminal police and his interrogation. But at the same time as that story unfolds, we backtrack and we start to see his earlier life, maybe about a decade or so earlier, who he was with, the sort of person he was, and what led him to want to take the life of Adolf Hitler. And that's really the arc of the film. And I mostly found it very, very engaging. And I was constantly trying to understand, why was this man who he was a musician, he was a carpenter, he wasn't a big, strong, tough, aggressive, macho bloke at all. He was rather a sensitive, fun-loving, romantic, an idealist.
He also seemed surprisingly uncommitted in his politics. The communists were forever trying to recruit him to their numbers, and while he wore the badge, he was never willing to commit, never willing to sign up for them. He was very much a spectator in many ways. He was more interested in seducing married women.
He was. But all around him, and this is what the film shows, all around him over the years that he was in the small village in the south of Germany, he could see the evidence of the increasing influence of the Nazis. His friends in the Red Front were being harassed and then eventually detained. He could see his one of the village leaders was very much a member of the Nazi Party and was corralling people to join up and to laud Adolf Hitler. So he could see all this happening around him. A woman he fell in love with, a married woman, was married to a Nazi who was a thug and a drunk and a violent man. So both emotionally and in just in terms of what the way he could live his life, it was encroaching on him more and more. And I guess we're left with the idea that he just was a man who also had all these skills as a carpenter. He worked at an armaments factory. He was a good with drawing. He could come up with a plan to build a bomb. He could construct it. He could get the explosives. And he could do all this just by himself.
Indeed, it comes out in his interrogation that the Gestapo, and indeed higher up in the Reich, they refused to believe that he could have acted alone, because that what he put together was too brilliant for one simple country man like him to have contrived. And yet it turns out that that's precisely what he did.
And he's a man who... Here's a question for you, Steve. Had you heard much of him before?
No, I hadn't.
No, me neither. I mean, I was aware of generally of the... There had been plots to kill Hitler, and there was a more well-known one towards the end of the war where various Nazi officers took part. And I'm going to come back to that in a bit, by the way. He, I don't think, was so well-known, and some of his family and the people in the village where he grew up were became the targets of intimidation by the Nazis after his capture. So his name in his own home area was besmirched for a long time. But I think in more recent years, there's been an attempt to raise his profile and acknowledge his heroism. I think even Angela Merkel has spoken about him publicly in recent times. And so this film actually is brought about, is directed by the same man, and this is kind of an interesting parallel, this man called Oliver Hirschbiegel. He's the director. He directed some years back a very well-acclaimed German film called Downfall. Downfall was the story of the last days of Hitler himself in his bunker in Berlin.
Yes, it's a very, very well-known account of Hitler's final days, isn't it?
It is. It was, and it was rather controversial for a time because some felt it went too far to humanise Hitler and to show some other slightly, I was going to say soft, that's not the right word, but saw human aspects of this man. They certainly depicted him as a madman. But anyway, so that was a very successful film. Hirschbiegel went on to do a rather a film that didn't attract such acclaim. That was that film called Diana, the one with Naomi Watts a couple of years ago.
Which was almost universally panned,
wasn't it? Yes, yes. And so, so now he's come back to his home soil to do another German story. I thought the story was, the film was put together really well. The lead actor, Christian Friedel, played the part extremely well, I thought. Well acted, well put together. And I just, throw this back to you, Steve. Do you feel by the end of it, though, did you feel you understood why this man would have undertaken all this by himself, keeping it to himself, really hardly telling anyone about it? Did that essential question, was that answered for you?
It almost felt, and I'm possibly being a bit cynical and maybe even a bit flippant here, but it almost felt like it fed into the typical cliche of German logic and dispassionate thinking. The sense that you got was that he analysed the situation and came to the conclusion that the only possible action for him to take was to assassinate Hitler. And since he had the skills to build the particular bomb that he did, then it was simply the logical progression that he would do this. And during his interrogation, he almost presents it in that way as, well, what else was I to do? This was the only logical path I could take. It almost lays it out that clearly.
Yes, it does. And maybe that was the truth of it. He just happened to be a man whose personality was disposed to that. He happened to have the skills which allowed him to do it, and he nearly changed the course of history by 13 minutes. It was one of his skills was not being a meteorologist, and he didn't know that there was going to be heavy, was it fog, I think, on the night of this big speech that Hitler was giving in Munich. And because of the fog, Hitler had to change his travel plans, and rather than catch the appointed flight, he took a train, which meant he left earlier. And 13 minutes, if he'd been in that hall 13 minutes longer, he would have been there when the bomb went off.
Yeah, I mean, the whole killing Hitler trope has been done many, many times before in fiction. You know, Inglourious Basterds ends with Hitler's death. It's obviously a fantasy wish fulfillment kind of story. We've got things like, I mean, a kill Hitler episode in Doctor Who, for pity's sake. Novels have been, there's a Stephen Fry novel that revolves around Hitler being assassinated in his youth. It's a very, very common thing. You very, very rarely see stories which allow Hitler to live. So I think it's actually quite a bold move, especially given that these days in Germany, a lot of the political mood there is understandably trying to put a huge gulf between present-day Germany and the Germany of the 1920s and 30s and 40s, which obviously is a regime one would wish to distance oneself from.
Yes, and at least I suppose you'd say this film, while it certainly shows how some in Germany were caught up by that Nazi fervour, we do see Elsa's and his family, for that matter, and others who were not, who resisted it and ultimately paid the price. Now, Steve, this is at the point where we must mention an incredibly coincidental link between these two films.
What possible link could there be between Mission Impossible and 13 Minutes? I'm drawing a blank.
Well, look, one of the two officials who questions George Elsa after he is caught, one of them is a real hardline head of the Gestapo, and he's Heinrich Müller. The other is the head of the criminal police, and he's Arthur Nebber. Now, Nebber in the film is seen, shown to be a slightly softer man, a bit more humanistic. He's more willing to sit down with a cup of coffee or a glass of water and talk to Elsa and try and get information out of him man to man.
He plays the good cop in the interrogation routine, doesn't he?
Yeah, Muller is the bad cop, and then some. He's the one who's pulling on the torture and everything else. Now, Nebber is also more inclined to believe that Elsa actually acted by himself. And this is one of the themes that carries on through the film. And at the end of the film, I won't give it completely away, but let's just say that Nebber comes to a particular... his story comes to a particular rather... dramatic conclusion.
Rather grim and rather abrupt end, yes.
Yes, which we could talk about separately. But now, Nebber turns out, and given that you say this is a piece of history, so there's no real issue about spoilers here, he was later accused of having a part in a completely different plot to assassinate Hitler. This was the famous one, probably the more famous one in 1944, when a group of Nazi officials and officers attempted to kill Hitler in the Wolf's Lair, this sort of bunker command center. Klaus von Stauffenberg was this colonel, was the guy, this is the chap who'd had lost an eye and some fingers in an explosion, played by Tom Cruise in a 2008 film called Valkyrie. So Tom Cruise was involved in a story about another assassination plot to kill Hitler involving a character who appeared in this film 13 minutes.
I have no words. I have no words. I'm in awe. That's just fantastic.
And how... I'm not even going to go there to talk about how well Tom Cruise's German accent was. I actually saw that film... did you see it, Valkyrie?
I avoided it.
Anyway, less said the better. All right, so we have had a good discussion about 13 minutes. I would recommend it, Steve. I thought it was very well acted, very well put together, telling a different story about a chap most people probably don't know so much about.
But maybe should know about.
It's actually a true story.
Absolutely, I would recommend it. It's not a light film. It's not easy viewing. But it's definitely worth a look.
Very good. Now, let's turn, shall we, to the matter of some music.
Just a little bit recently is a rather intriguing project from a band from Missouri in the US named the Hillbenders. I wasn't previously aware of them. They describe themselves as a somewhat disregarded, not to nothing bluegrass band. The standard bluegrass setup, they've got a banjo, they've got a fiddle, they've got a slap bass, and they've been doing your typical bluegrass numbers until recently for reasons that don't seem entirely clear. They've turned their attention to Tommy, the rock opera from The Who from the 1970s. And it's an odd little thing. It really is. I can't decide what to make of it. Simon, you've listened to a track or two. What do you think?
It is an interesting one. It poses a couple of interesting questions when you hear something like this, when you hear a completely different take on some music that you might know rather well or a band that you might know rather well. I quite like that sort of bluegrassy, country bluesy take on things. And at first I was drawn to it. But after a period of time, for example, if you listen to Pinball Wizard, I guess that's the most well-known track, of course, inevitably my mind goes back to The Who's version. And I'm still thinking of Roger Daltrey's vocals and Pete Townsend's guitar, and that's the version that will still remain with me for the longest. So there's, I guess the question is, do you treat this as a bit of a novelty, or does it stand on its own two feet rather well? And I liked it initially. I'm not sure how long I'll keep on liking it for.
Yeah, I'm leaning, unfortunately, more and more towards novelty. I've tried listening to, in particular, Pinball Wizard is the obvious place to start, because it's obviously going to be the song that most people know best. And I do hear shades of Roger Daltrey's voice in this particular version. I don't know that they've done enough to make it different. It's not terribly bluegrass, really. The instruments are there, but the stylings aren't. It's bluegrass light, really. It's almost as though they weren't quite brave enough to have the courage of their convictions and go full bluegrass on it. It's good, but it leaves you asking the question, why?
It does, it does. Interesting, when you look online, you can see some clips on YouTube of them playing in front of a live audience, and there's a version of... it's See Me, Feel Me. And they're playing in front of a rather smallish audience there, but it's an audience that look as if they're in their 50s and 60s, just sitting around under a canvas awning. And they are really into it. And I just wonder, there's an element of the power of a live performance here, which I wonder with this sort of music, it's pretty evocative. It's kind of soulful if you're sitting there and you're watching it and listening to it right in front of your face. Where maybe that's where it's best, that's the best place to absorb it and to listen to it is go and see them. And that maybe that would give it a different power and a different depth.
And it's interesting that you mentioned the live performances, because apparently they're now, the Hillbenders are touring a complete performance of the entire album. Ah. They're calling it Hoograss. That's their word, not mine. In fact, if anyone's interested, hoograss.com is the website where you can find more information about this. Apparently, they're largely touring this in the US at the moment for obvious reasons. But they're doing the entire album, and it's an interesting thing. It brings together two trends that have, one's been well established for years, doing cover versions of songs. People have been recording other people's music for as long as people have been recording music, obviously. It's the first time I've... Well, not the first time. It's one of the first times I've heard of an entire album being reproduced by another artist.
Yes.
A famous example that comes to mind is Liz Phair's tribute to the Stones' Exile on Main Street when she did Exile in Guyville. So there have been people who have referenced albums in their completeness in the past, but it's a rare thing to do, covering an entire album. But performing albums on stage in their entirety is a new thing that's starting to emerge, where established acts are going back into their back catalogue and doing complete performances of whole albums.
Yes.
But this is the first time I've heard of someone doing a complete performance of somebody else's album.
You're right. Tribute albums where you get a variety of artists coming together to perform someone else's work, that's been around since forever.
Yes.
And I thought when you talked about artists, you know, playing their own albums, you were inviting me to mention one Mr. Springsteen, weren't you? I know you couldn't help it, and I couldn't help it.
I know you can't help it, Simon. Go on. You've opened the door, step through it.
Well, I happen to know that for several years now, Springsteen in his live tours has been playing probably three or four of his albums in their entirety, usually halfway through his set. And in the order in which they appear on the album. And he did that in Auckland a couple of years ago when he was here on the Saturday night at Mount Smart. He played the whole of Born in the USA, and the next night he played the whole of Born to Run. And that is interesting for, I think, if you're familiar with an artist's work, to hear the whole thing live as they conceived it, as they wanted it constructed, but to hear it not on the record, on the vinyl or whatever else, but to see the person perform it. That's kind of special. It's a special thing, but to do it for someone else, that's the ultimate, paying the ultimate tribute, isn't it, Steve? I mean, what else could you possibly do to say, hey, we think you're good?
I'm going to be a tad bit more cynical about this. I feel, in the end, after having listened to it a few times and having read a little bit more about the band, it feels a little bit self-consciously clever and wacky and zany. And maybe I need to listen to it a bit more, maybe I'll get more out of it. At this point, I can't quite bring myself to get behind this. I'm sorry. I've tried. Yeah. Trust me, I've tried.
Here's the question, though. If they came out here, would you go see them?
More than likely. I'm not that cynical.
All right. Now, so that's the Hillbenders with their version of The Who's Tommy. Hoograss, as Steve said. What a
no, no, as they said, I'm distancing myself. I'm distancing myself from that one. That was not yourself. Mine.
Okay.
Not mine.
We caught a very impressive act from Manchester the other week, Steve. He's worth a mention. Johnny Marr.
Most definitely. Now, this goes back to my childhood growing up in Salford, where I should have been a huge Smiths fan. A lot of my mates were back in the 1980s in the northwest of England, and I wasn't. I just found it to be music to open a vein to be quite honest about it. I found it to be maudlin and miserable. But I did find myself at Johnny Marr's solo concert at the Power Station in Auckland with you, Simon, a week ago, and it was time to reassess what I thought of Johnny Marr. I was most impressed.
I'll be honest, I didn't know so much about him. I'm a little bit older than you, and I wasn't, not by much, Steve, but I didn't really, was someone who was into the Smiths, so I knew of the Smiths. I'd heard his name. I wasn't so familiar with his material, but I was really impressed with him. He had a lot of energy, a bit of attitude. He could play the guitar. His vocals were pretty good. I know he wasn't obviously the lead singer in the Smiths, but his vocals, he was in pretty good shape. And I thought he paced his show really, really well, with the odd slower number in between some much more energetic songs, which really got everyone totally into it. And, of course, he had a very, very surprising guest pop up right at the end.
Yeah, no one was quite expecting that. I mean, everyone was there really to see Johnny Marr. I think there were a few people in the audience who were there to see a Smith. We'll never see the Smiths again. So a lot of people were doing, you know, they figured this was the closest they're going to get. But his solo material was very, very well received. But yeah, I think the highlight of the show for most people was the last two songs of the encore.
Yes, the band went off at the end of their first set. And then we saw an extra microphone come onto the stage, an extra microphone stand. And, of course, everyone starts thinking, who is it for? And you start racking your brains to think, A, is there any other international act touring? Or B, is there some other local artist of such stature that Johnny Marr would be very happy to share the stage with them? So the band comes on and he introduces. He gave him a heck of a rap, didn't he, Steve? Sort of one of the best singer-songwriters around.
I think the phrase "in the world" got trotted out at one point, which, to be fair, when you're addressing a Kiwi audience, is probably going to go down quite well, isn't it, really?
Yes, we're talking about Neil Finn, and he got a heck of a reception, and they did a couple of songs and did them really well.
Well, for the most part.
I thought there was one slight stumble on lyrics in the first song, but anyway, putting that to one side.
Well, you know, you're not the only person. I've spoken to a couple of the people who were at the show who do reckon the Neil Finn, and I know this is heresy in New Zealand, I'm going to say it anyway, the man's only human. He did fluff I Fought the Law at one point.
Yes, he did. But, I thought he did, yeah.
But he recovered. He recovered because the man's a professional.
He was. And the last song, and I've forgotten the title already, Steve, but that last song was a brilliant song. The audience was singing it and really getting into it.
There is a light that never goes out.
Wow, wonderful, wonderful song.
A Smith's classic, and again, one of their more miserable lyrics, but quite brilliant. I was impressed. I mean, frankly, I was happy when they closed the main set with How Soon Is Now, which is my favourite Smith song. Like I said, I'm not a huge fan of the band, but that one song I find to be absolutely compelling. And it was an amazing workout, given the song itself basically revolves around one single chord, pretty much. There's obviously more to it than just that, but it's essentially a one chord song, and I thought that Marr did brilliantly. It's a hard song to play live, I gather, and it was fantastic. I was very impressed.
Yeah, that was very, very good. I'd certainly recommend it to anyone, and if he comes back, well worth looking at. Johnny Marr at the Auckland Power Station just the other week.
Brilliant.
agree with you. I did watch the first series of True Detective, and I was really impressed. I thought having both Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, two highly acclaimed film actors, although Harrelson started in TV, of course, way back in Cheers, being the leads in a television series worked really, really well. Very high production values, a really strong script and a story, and an interesting hook to the storytelling. Again, it's that going back in time thing, but it was done, I thought, very, very well, and McConaughey's haunted character really drove that story extremely well. So they set the bar very, very high in that first series. I haven't had a chance to catch the second series, Steve, but do you think they've maintained that level so far?
No.
Oh.
Yes, it's disappointing. I agree with everything you said about the first series. It was tight, it was sharp. And I think the most important thing is it was very, very focused and uncluttered. It was very clearly about the two central characters. We knew, we didn't know what the hell was going on with them, but we knew who they were.
Yes.
We knew exactly who they were, and it was about them. We knew the two characters, and we knew there was something involving these two characters, that they had been partners, and something had gone completely pear-shaped with them. That was it. And the story unfolded quite beautifully. What I'm seeing with series two, and let's face it, there is some great acting in it. We've got two lead characters played by Vince Vaughn, and we've got Colin Farrell, both of whom are doing very well in this series. I maybe Vince Vaughn is hoping for what's being referred to in Matthew McConaughey's case as a reconnaissance. We think he's possibly hoping for, again, not one of mine, but I would take credit for that line. I think maybe people are hoping to see Vince Vaughn redeem himself after some of the clunkers and howlers he's been making lately. But the problem is, the mix is so muddy. It's not clear. Okay, I accept it's not clear what's happening in the story yet, but that was also true for the first several episodes of the first series.
Yes.
But at least we knew who the characters were, and we could figure out where they were heading. We could see the path they were taking. This time round, it's muddy, it's murky, it's very, very unclear. And it's simply because so much was flung at the screen in the first episode. Too many characters, too many timelines, too many different stories and arcs and threads, and too much going on at once. What it lacks so far is the laser focus on one central dynamic. And that's what the entire of the first series revolved around in the end. The present day sequences in the first series were commentary around the focus, which was the flashback sequences,
yes,
between McConaughey and Harrelson, and that was phenomenal. What the series is lacking, so the new series is lacking so far, is anything like a crystal clear focus, and I think that's going to be its biggest problem unless it pulls itself together.
Right, right. Well, it's got a few more episodes to go, but it's not a long series. The first, I think six episodes in the first season. I'm not sure if they're doing the similar number this time round. So it doesn't have a huge, it's not like a 13 or 14 parts a season where you've got a huge slow burn. They've really got to get it together pretty quickly.
I need to see this thing tightened up considerably if it's going to get me watching for a third series.
All right. Okay, well, thanks for that. And I must admit, when I saw Vince Vaughn's name there, I tend to think of him automatically, as you say, as a bit of a comic actor, and not one who's been in some well-regarded comedies for that matter either. So that was always
not for a very long time,
yeah,
no.
So that was always going to be a big ask to get an audience to accept him and as a serious dramatic actor. So, yeah, interesting.
And that's all we have time for this week. You can find us online at cravepodcast.com, and you can find us on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
And that's us for this week. I'm Simon Mercep.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's Crave. Right.